Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so that people who need social work get help that will transform their lives. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jo. And this is podcast 1A of series 3, Jerry. It's the start of a new series. And last podcast, we completed series 2 with our review of the year, although we did kind of move on into what's going to happen in the future as well.
Absolutely.
And we really hope that you enjoy the podcast. Let us know what you're thinking by visiting our website, www.helpfulsocialwork.com, or by commenting on iTunes. We really look forward to hearing from you.
Today we're going to start series 3, which is a journey along the path of social work practice. So during series 3, we'll be exploring how social workers work with people. We're going into the encounters that happen, the direct practice that happens, and we'll be thinking about that journey from first contact through assessment and planning and review and up to either transition or closure at the end of our work. And each month we're going to be looking at a stage in that path, although it's not always kind of direct, is it? Sometimes it's quite windy and there's sort of branches off it and twists and turns.
We've chosen this topic, contact, because that's the beginning of the journey when someone first makes contact with social services. And it might not be a social worker that they first speak to, but the moment they encounter our profession in the midst of whatever situation they're in, it's this moment that sets the tone for the whole of their experience. So it's absolutely critical that we get this right. We need to be able to act ethically. We need to be able to act capably. And we need to have clarity about what's needed and how to go about it. But as well as that, we need to be able to maintain curiosity about the person on the other side of the encounter. So it's important for us to be able to say who we are, why we're there, what we can do, what we can't do, all those kind of boundary issues and all those threshold issues and all the things that offer that make our offer clear. But by the same token, we have to keep an open mind and not just kind of bustle in with an agenda. Yeah. And so I think that's one of the tricks of those starts of journeys. How can we stay curious about somebody?
Yes, because we're thinking of first contact from the point of view of a social worker making contact with a family or with a person for the first time. But it's quite unlikely that I, as the social worker, or that you, will be the first social services person that this individual or family has come into contact with. We might be, but we may be part of quite a long journey they've already had. And that thing about not going in with assumptions is really important, because we don't know what they're bringing from their past experiences. And with an open mind and with curiosity, we've got a chance to kind of reset the relationship and reestablish trust by starting with who they are at that moment. We talked a little bit, didn't we, about overcoming previous experiences, that it's not just what you do in this encounter, but what's happened before.
I think that's right. For me, I think that every encounter can lower our expectations of the help and attention that we're going to receive. And so that can lead to people kind of going through the motions without investing too much of themselves. And for me, when you don't invest yourself in an encounter, what you hold back normally are things like hopefulness and motivation and energy and a kind of real partnership. And so you just keep those things in reserve because you don't have faith in the helpfulness that's going to be received, that's going to be offered. And I think that means that the encounter has more chance of failure. And I see this in children. You know, by the time you're somebody's fifth or sixth social worker, they've got a pretty good idea in their head of what a social worker does, but more importantly, what a social worker can't do. And I remember actually working with a 10-year-old boy who said to me that every time social work got involved in his family, his mum, who had mental health problems, got worse.
Right. So he actually saw it as he came at it with a feeling that this is likely to make things worse. rather than better.
Yep.
Yeah. And I remember going to see an older woman in hospital to talk to her about planning for her to leave hospital. And she had a Daily Mail open on her lap with a headline about the terrible state of residential care homes and all the bad things that went on there. It was a kind of an expose. This was some years ago. And she kind of looked at me across this newspaper, and her gaze was full of kind of sort of hostility, but anxiety as well. But this real kind of, don't you dare try and put me in one of these places. She was coming from a real kind of different place than me, because I thought of residential care homes as quite helpful in lots of ways.
And I think that's a really good point as well, because what you're talking about then is the influence that the media and that public stories can actually have on our first encounters, because it's not just have they encountered a residential home before, or have they encountered an adult social worker before, or a children's social worker. It's what do they know of that role, and what stories do they understand about the type of help we offer. And certainly even in early help in children's services, people will have a fear that we're going to take their children away.
Yeah, and there can be a lot of stigma, can't there, around that encounter. Yeah. So that it's, you're not starting from a place of neutrality. You're quite often starting from a place of difficulty and having to work through that before you can make progress.
But then think about the stories that social workers bring into their encounters. Like if I'm a social worker who has received a case that says that there's domestic violence in the family, or that says that there's drug and alcohol misuse, or says that there's concerns around children getting to school, or whatever it is that they say about that family that triggers me being involved, I then have all the other encounters I've had with other people who have drug and alcohol problems. I have all of the learning that I have around, for instance, what we used to call, and I know there's a drive to change it now, the toxic trio. What happens when there's drug and alcohol, mental health and domestic violence in a family? And all of that comes through the door with me. So in the same way as there's preconceptions on one side, there is on the other. And sometimes if you're not careful to be curious about the humanity of the person in front of you and wanting to meet them as an individual, it can just be like the meeting of two sets of preconceptions, can't it?
Yes. Yeah, one of the difficulties we have is that we do need to use experience and expertise, but we also need to come in with an individual take on each situation, a new take on each situation, and we need to be really conscious of the bias that we're experiencing, including our own beliefs and values and the kind of stereotypes that we might be prone to. And we may have heard, as you say, a lot about the person before we meet them, and we may have a lot of associations with that information. And also when we meet someone, we may come up against something that really resonates with us, but we have to resist making assumptions and putting labels onto people. And I think the code of ethics is quite a good place to start, because it says that social work is based on respect for the inherent worth and dignity of all people. So if we go in thinking how can we act from a place where we respect that person and their inherent dignity, then that can be a helpful way of overcoming some of those assumptions.
Yes, I think that that's a really good place to start. And for me, it's about also really being curious about what people want from us. Like, what is it that people are looking for from us, and what does a good service look like for us?
Yeah, so the reason that we talk to managers about customer service is because the definition of it is that good customer service is something where the offer meets the expectations. But those expectations come from the customer. So a good service is really what the customer says that it is, rather than what an organisation believes to be the case. And that can sometimes happen in social services, kind of, that we go in with a, this is what we can do for you kind of approach, rather than what is it that you're looking for?
I guess it's about co-production, isn't it? It's about always going in, trying to look for the strengths and resiliences that people are bringing to the table, building on them. And someone was saying, as I was talking to you earlier, I was saying that I'd been to this conference at Wolverhampton yesterday, which was very inspiring, but they kept talking about the fact that you need to really define people by what it is they can do in their life.
Mm.
And not what it is they can't do in their life. And that if you go in there curious about what they're managing to do,
mm-hmm.
as well as their aspirations, what they want to do in the future, then it will make the joint solving of the problems much easier.
Mm. And we've got some real problems in social care about offering good customer service, about that trade of, you know, you expect this and I provide it, because firstly, people aren't really customers. A lot of people are involuntary. They don't choose to use social care. A lot of people don't want it. So how we relate to them has to be about their rights and their needs and their citizenship, rather than about them really being customers. And it's also complicated by the fact that we've got different stakeholders. So we're there to promote welfare of children and well-being of adults, and that's for those people, but it's also something for the benefit of the community, for the benefit of society. We're accountable to government, we're accountable to our professional regulator. And so there's competing expectations sometimes, and being really clear about what those are and saying, well, this might be your expectation, but actually what I'm able to do is this, this and this. And then the other really big problem we have is power. You know, we usually hold the power. Or, you know, it's held by our organisation that we're representatives of, or we are seen as representatives of the government. So it's kind of held by anyone really, apart from the person who we're going to meet. So we've got a lot of work to do to overcome that power imbalance as well, which is tied into people's previous experiences and their experience of other times where they've been powerless or experienced oppression.
I don't like calling the people we work with customers, but it's really hard to work out how you reference somebody in a way that ensures that you think of them as an equal and mm-hmm. someone who is contributing to the party and who has rights. But for me, one of the things that I do think is I believe a lot of the people we work with do want help, actually.
Mm.
I think a lot of people are struggling in the situation they're in, and they're not comfortable in that situation, and they'd like to have a change in it. And so I think that they're looking for helpfulness. It's just that they want helpfulness without judgment, and helpfulness without stigma, and helpfulness without humiliation or shame. And I think one of the problems that we have, because of the public perception of social work, and also because of some of the structures that we use, is that we evoke that sense of shame onto people so strongly that what we do is not seen as helpful because it's too painful to receive.
Yeah.
And I do think that's one of our struggles when we're genuinely trying to have a good first encounter. How do you come across as a person interested in working with another person to solve their issues, rather than as a rescuer running in to save somebody, or as a social policeman rushing in to condemn somebody, or as someone who's so powerful that they can take you out of your home and put you in what you perceive from what the newspapers have said is a dangerous environment.
Yeah. And I think the anti-oppressive practice approach does help here, because that recognises, similar to the social model of disability, actually recognises that the issues that people face don't all come from them. They come from barriers that they face that prevent them from realising all their potential. And those are personal and cultural and structural barriers. So personal barriers are the way that personal characteristics are used to stereotype or limit people. So just because somebody's part of a particular group or has a particular characteristic, they may have faced limitations through their whole life, or maybe just recently if something's changed. And there's cultural barriers around how we're socialized to think of some people as deserving or undeserving, or successful or unsuccessful, or, you know, normal or different somehow, or dangerous, all those kind of labels that we put on people. And then there's structural barriers around how we make it actually easier for some people to get on and harder for others. If we talk to people about those barriers, the personal, cultural and structural barriers that they face, and we recognise kind of our own place in those and our own potential to make them worse, then together we can figure out how to remove and overcome some of them. So it's really trying to understand someone's experience of barriers and limitations on their potential and appreciate their attributes and what they can contribute to overcome them, and how we can empower them to overcome those barriers as well. So it's not fixing the person, it's looking at what's holding them back. And if we come in with the mindset of what's holding you back rather than what's wrong with you, I think that's just a really, it's a much more equal place to start.
It's nice language, isn't it? And I really like the personal barriers, cultural barriers and structural barriers as the three concepts. It's really helpful to be able to check them in your own mind. What is it personally, the personal characteristics or the stereotypes that I'm putting on this person? What are the cultural barriers that this person might be encountering or that I might be bringing into the situation? And what are the structural barriers that they're encountering or that I'm bringing into the situation?
Yeah, because if we bring in a form that's like 20 pages long for someone who, you know, that's just not their thing, that's a structural barrier straight away, isn't it?
Yep. And it's the same as if you have a meeting where there's 11 or 12 other professionals and you and your child. That's a structural barrier too, because it straight away tips the power. And I know that there's been good work done about these things, but I would love to see those three areas looked at in supervision, in case supervision. I think it could be a really helpful way to prompt people's thoughtfulness. And I think the other thing here is that we're kind of imagining that first encounter, but we also need to recognize that some people don't even get as far as a social work encounter, because sometimes people experience barriers to accessing and using social care support, and these include a lack of awareness, cultural barriers, stigma, discrimination, social and economic barriers, service criteria, as well as past experience. And that is something that was really driven home to me yesterday. I was in this conference at Wolverhampton, and I know I've mentioned this before. You think I don't get out much, but I do. there was a very powerful talk from a woman who had dementia and her daughter who was her carer. Mm-hmm. And in that talk, she spoke about the fact that the things that she wanted from services were around helping her stay connected to her community, helping her to have new experiences, helping her to socialize and to go outside her home. And the things that were being offered to her, the packages they had, were all around care, food, self-care, cleaning, all sorts of things to maintain her staying in the home. But actually that wasn't her issue, because her daughter had given up work to care for her. And the daughter then spoke and said, and the places we've been offered where my mum could go are places that have been set up for older people. And neither of us feel like we belong there. So there was some real barriers around them getting the support they felt they needed to be able to continue to live a meaningful life for both of them, the carer and the parent.
Yeah. So there's some particular issues around, are we actually accessible to people who might need social work? You know, are we known? Are we trusted? How do we make that more the case? You know, that people know about us, that they trust us, that they can find us and can access us. And then there's also some things we wanted to share about what people have said they want from social workers when they turn up. So there's some useful things from children's feedback, young people's feedback, that the Children's Workforce Development Council collected. And they broke into kind of three areas, really. So practical things. They wanted us to turn up on time, to actually turn up at all, but to be on time as well. Those kind of practical things. Ethical areas around paying attention and listening and being engaged, and then some kind of more medium term things around building a relationship and communicating and explaining what's going on. And in our next podcast, we're going to be talking about building the relationship, which starts with the first contact, but kind of grows from there. And that fits with some work that I did recently with carers about how social workers can best work with them. And they talked about some things that you really should do, like you need to be prepared and explain yourself and listen to people and see the carer as an asset, as part of a support network. And there were some things that they said that you just mustn't do. So don't appear to be in a rush. Don't make assumptions. Don't make promises you can't keep. And there was a really interesting thing where one of the carers said that sometimes people turn up and they just look like they're not in a position to help you. You know, they look stressed and rushed and not kind of
available.
They are preoccupied. Available. And that's just makes people feel worse. So,
well, once again, you would pull back any investment you were going to make into that relationship, wouldn't you?
Mm.
Because you would just think that you would already feel dismissed.
Yeah.
And the truth is that we don't mean to do that, because we've all experienced this. I experience, you know, at the moment I'm going through my own journey in the healthcare world, and I experience this from different practitioners. And if practitioners don't make eye contact with me at the beginning and they sit there typing on their computer, or they hand me a print-off sheet before they've even listened to where I am in my journey, then I experience that as a signal that they don't have time for me.
Mm.
Not me, the person. Do you know what I mean? They're not really seeing me. They're just seeing whatever the appointment issue is that's been written down.
Yeah, and this is where it is difficult, because we don't want to state the obvious too much or suggest that social workers don't know how to be social workers. But I think given the level of pressure that's on people in practice, there is that risk that we will go into an encounter thinking, I've got to get out to see this person, but actually we won't be ready to be available. We won't have the energy to be available, and we can do more harm than good then, I think. You know, it's not enough just to turn up, is it? You've got to turn up present, be fully present.
And I think you're right that, of course, social workers know this stuff, and they know about the importance of first contact, and we will be preaching to the choir. However, sometimes we are tired. Sometimes we are busy. Sometimes we are preoccupied. And unfortunately, sometimes that coincides with the first time that we've had contact or an encounter with somebody.
Yeah.
And there's a cost to it.
Yeah, I think the implications for practice then are, firstly, make sure you're fit to go out to see someone. And if you feel like you're not, seek support, because it's not going to help you or the other person to have that poor encounter. And then when you do go out, keeping an open mind, listening to what people want from us, and being able to explain ourselves and to kind of manage expectations in dialogue rather than this is what I can do for you, and kind of closing that down, being curious and taking that anti-oppressive approach of what's holding you back, where are your strengths, where can we work from, what can we build on, and trying to be kind of practical and respectful. And if we get it wrong, you know, it's not the end of the world, is it, that you can apologize and rebuild from an encounter that doesn't quite work. So long as we're listening, we can fix things as we go along as well. And I think people can tell good intentions, can't they, even if we don't always quite get it right.
Well, in fact, we can't always get it right, because if we could always get it right, then that would imply that we had all the answers. But one of the things that you said that carers wanted was they wanted to be seen as an asset.
Mm.
And if you're having an encounter with somewhere where you see them as an asset, then that means that you're going to ask questions, lots of questions. And some of those questions aren't going to be the right questions, are they?
No.
But if they're coming from a good place, then. Yeah, they're going to be curious. And I think that's right. The other thing is that I reflected on all of this, right, was particularly when you were talking about, you said here that a good service is what the customer says that it is rather than what an organisation believes to be the case, which I thought was a fantastic point. But it really made me think about the social work experience and how social workers feed back to government and to organisations they work for, talking about how they experience their workplace and how they experience the expectations on them and how they experience caseloads and how they experience the amount of time they have to do direct work and what happens to that feedback. Because it's often reported, isn't it, in community care, or BASWA takes it up, or people talk about it, we talk about it. But a lot of the time, actually, it doesn't change things for a lot of people who are practicing.
Yeah.
And sometimes, for some people, those things are dismissed. And so people are told, look, it's just a matter of doing it differently. It's a matter of thinking about what you write. It's a matter of prioritising the child. And when you're told those things, I wonder then how easy it is to go out and take on board what the person you're meeting with is telling you about how they experience your service.
Yeah, because I think you have to believe that things can change and know that from your own experience before you can really be a change agent for someone else. And if you've been closed down on improving things and not being listened to, some of that, you want the organisation to treat you in the way that, in with a relationship that is like the one that you want to have with people when you go out. So you want there to be a mirroring, don't you, between how you are with people in the community or the people that you go and work with and how you are back in the office. Otherwise, you have to work so hard to manage that incongruence, to leave a place that isn't empowering and anti-oppressive and hopeful, and go out and be those things to someone else.
And I think we always have to hold that in mind, that for some social workers in this country, their experiences won't be as healthy and helpful as some other social workers. And so they have to manage that as well.
Yeah. We have a few tools or exercises that might be helpful to people. So the first one is to think about how you define yourself or how I define myself, what elements of my identity are important to me, and how might that affect how I see others and what I emphasize as important to them. So from my own identity, then I might transfer some of those factors as important to other people, and that might not be what's important to them. So it's good to kind of think about where we're coming from. There's the anti-oppressive practice model, which is where you think about the ways that personal, cultural and structural oppressions can affect people and how someone's power is going to be limited, so that you can start to think about some of the barriers that you might need to work with them to overcome. And then there's also some really good advice that came from a resource that young people in Gloucestershire put together, which was kind of things that social workers should do. And one of them was, think about how you would feel if we were asking you those questions. And I just think that's really great advice, isn't it? To sit down with the questions that you're likely to ask someone on a first encounter and think, how would it feel for me to have to answer that? And maybe work with colleagues to ask each other those questions and reflect on the emotional and intellectual impact of that.
All of this matters, Jerry, because we leave a mark on people's life, for good or for ill, every encounter. And I always, when I'm talking with social workers, I say it's like a child is like one of those beanbag bears, you know, the little soft bears that are filled with little beans.
I do, yeah.
And it's like they've got like a little tear in the corner of them, and we pass them from place to place to place, asking them questions and assessing them and doing all sorts of things. And if we don't mend the tear, if we don't notice it or if we don't have time or we don't have the right tools to do it, then as we pass them along, they just lose a few more beans. And you can think of those beans as hope. And so as they get moved around and around and around the system, what they're leaking is hopefulness. And so sometimes by the time they get to the door of social work, they're almost empty, those little bean bears, and they're just flat because what they've given away is all their hope. And so I think it is really important that we think of every encounter as an opportunity to build hopefulness in people, and to do that through anti-oppressive practice, through being really mindful about what it is that they bring and what it is they hope for from that encounter, I think is a really good place to start.
So we'll just finish with a couple of reflective points, which are: what support can I gain to help me to work anti-oppressively? And that's particularly if I'm experiencing oppression myself. And when have I overcome barriers to make a connection of helpfulness and hopefulness with someone, so that I can learn from that and build on that for future encounters?
Okay, well, that sounds like a good place to finish. So thanks a lot, Jerry. That's been really thought-provoking.
Thank you, Joe.